Rollins has won it. They stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins by near third. This game is over.
A complete game. What a performance by Cliff Lee.
Victorino in the alley calling. He's got it. And the Phillies are going back to the World Series.
Welcome to Continued Success, your weekly emotional check-in with the Philadelphia Phillies. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight. With me is Liz Rocher of Yahoo Sports. Good morning, Liz.
Good morning, Justin.
Liz, is Aaron Nola an ace?
Yes!
right. Well, the Phillies, I only ask because the Phillies were a runaway from bookending their season with the Braves, their season series with the Braves, with a pair of sweeps. As we all remember, they started the season dominantly sweeping the Braves in three games. They lost 5-4 yesterday in the matinee series finale, in which they could have, if they had won, they would have swept the Braves at the beginning of the season and again here at the end with a lot of really less fun stuff happening in the middle. But they did win their season series with the Braves. Braves did not clinch while playing against the Phillies. A couple of minor wins there. But, I mean, how much would it have meant to you to see the Phillies hold fast against the Braves, come back, win that game, and at least have the very quiet bragging rights of saying, hey, we won the season series, and we swept you at the beginning and the end?
It would have been an empty victory.
Interesting.
Because this season, I mean, they're not going to the playoffs. Like, you could take, it's a small victory, but, I mean, they're going to probably lose their season series with the Marlins.
Yes.
So I can't take too much, you know, when you look at it like that, it's such a ridiculous crapshoot sometimes that, you know, it's hard to take pleasure or any confidence from it. You know, I mean, I wish they had won. I aggressively said at the beginning when I saw the lineup posted for Tuesday's game, I will not be watching this game. And I did not.
I too said that. That's, you're talking about the game where they started Sean Rodriguez and Jose Perella.
And Jose Perella. Jose Perella, mm-hmm. who then
hit a home run.
waggled his genitals in all of our faces and hit a home run. Of course, I'm looking at the score on at bat and I see that they almost coughed up the victory. I'm like, yeah, that's about right.
Sure. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, none of these wins felt very dominant, you know. At the beginning of the season it was like, oh yeah, sweet. This is how this team's going to be. They won that first game 10-4. Mm-hmm. That was the series where the Michael Franco is the best 8-hole in the league. Discussion came from. I mean, mm-hmm. they intentionally walked Bryce Harper at one point to load the bases for Rhys Hoskins, who then hit a grand slam. I mean, I was literally reading an article on FanGraphs about touting the Phillies for their depth. From that point in the season, their depth, which has become such an issue for them,
for the second
such
year
a problem.
In a row.
Yeah, I mean, this was a different team back then. Like, it just goes to show the contrast between the beginning and end of the season. And actually,
it's not a different team. It was the same team the whole time. We just didn't know it yet, and neither did they.
Well, we're gonna. I ask about the how much the sweeping the Braves would have meant to you, just because we're gonna talk about this in a little bit, just expectations and context, because the Phillies, in a sense, talked about expectations and context this week, and we're gonna talk about them talking about that. But yeah, before we begin, I'm sorry I shouted that Aaron Nola question at you at the top of the show, because this loss yesterday, this 5-4 loss to the Braves, was the Phillies' sixth straight loss with Aaron Nola on the mound. Now, I remember when that number was 3, and I was like, huh.
We were so young then.
That's a number to watch. And here they are, 3 games later, having lost again with him on the mound. I mean, he went 5 innings against the Braves. He allowed 9 hits, 5 earned runs, 2 walks, 2 home runs. You know, not great. Across the dugout, though, you know, the Braves starter, Mike Soroka, he only went 5 innings. He allowed 5 hits, 2 earned runs, and didn't walk anybody. So he had a slightly better day. But comparatively, you know, they both went not very deep into the game. And, you know, Nola's last couple starts, I don't know. I mean, I think he's still, obviously, still an ace. We've mentioned on this podcast how he maybe deserves a little more scrutiny as far as being, you know, holding up Phillies close games or just giving them a win. This is not the work of a stopper, you know, somebody who, depending on who you blame, but in 6 games, I think that Aaron Nola should have probably, you know, been able to force a win in one or two of those games. In his last seven games, he has a 4.46 ERA. He's lasted 42 and a third innings in seven starts. He's allowed 16 walks and 47 strikeouts. So this hasn't been the best Aaron Nola. And, you know, even Sarah Lang's from, I believe, ESPN. It was when the Phillies were on ESPN against the Braves. I believe it was the night before the season finale. She was tweeting some stats about the Phillies. And, you know, first of all, I saw the Phillies game come up on ESPN and was like, oh, the Phillies are on ESPN tonight. And then my fiance was like, but you hate the Phillies. And I was like, I do. Why is that exciting?
That's what I saw the same thing. Hey, they're on ESPN. And then there was a pause. And then Sean and I both groaned. We're like, oh, God, why? Because we felt compelled to not just mention it out loud to each other, but then to watch it, which we didn't. But we felt like we had an obligation because they were on. We're like, no, why would we do that?
Well, yesterday during Aaron Nola's start
Sarah, which I did watch some of. I did relent and actually watch the Phillies baseball.
Sarah Langs tweeted, since the start of 2018, Aaron Nola's ERA from March to August is 2.77, and in September it is 4.63. So there's a chance that the time of year has something to do with this, though I don't know how much credence do you give the idea that, like, oh yeah, but just when the ninth month of the calendar rolls around, Aaron Nola forgets how to pitch. Or is it more that, like, yeah, you know, he hasn't learned how to not be burned out by the end of the season?
I mean, maybe it's that. It's also just, what, two Septembers?
Yes.
I feel like that's a little tough to make a, you know, a definitive statement about it. But it could be that. I mean, it happens to a lot of players this time of year, especially when you're not playing for anything anymore. I mean, Gabe Kapler could say whatever he wants. All the players have brains and eyes, I think. They can all see how far away they are in the standings. You know, individual wins are good, but when you have something else, you know, a little bit more abstract to play for, like going to the playoffs or, you know, going to that wild card play-in game. I don't know, maybe it would spur him along a little bit more. You know, he's still young. I mean, how old is he? He's 26.
Yeah.
He's 26. He's actually young. Like, we say that and we take a look, the guy's like, oh God, he's almost 29. No, he's like, Aaron Nola is still, I mean, he's entering his prime. And so, I mean, I can't, we know who he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you look at his stats this year, he's made 33 starts. I think he'll make one more, if not one or two more starts. His ERA is like 3.75. Like, I was comparing his stats. Like, I feel like he's having a very 2009 Cole Hamels season.
Yeah. You know, difference being the Phillies had a World Series title at that point. But yes.
They did, but this was, you know, 2008 was Cole Hamels' breakout season. Yes. During the regular season, he had, a 3.09 ERA. He made 33 starts. He pitched the most innings he had ever pitched, 227. You know, he was the ace. And then everyone spent the next year yelling in his face, you're not an ace. Why aren't you doing better?
Yeah. And I mean, I think the point is, think about this team the way it is now and think about it without Aaron Nola. And it's much, much worse.
Yeah. I mean, this is a top 10 pitcher.
Like,
exactly. And the thing that we get with him, even when he's not doing well, when he's having some trouble like he has this year, what you get when you have him on the mound is the possibility of brilliance every time.
Mm-hmm.
Even like this. Like, we used last year, we felt like there was more of a guarantee when he would step on the mound. This year, there's a little less of that because he hasn't been doing as well. But there's still the possibility. And there's a strong possibility, as opposed to literally any other starting pitcher the Phillies have. When you put that guy on the mound, you're like, oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
How bad is it going to be today? You know, Zach Eflin did well in his last start, which is good. I have long supported Zach Eflin in that I would like to stop talking about him because because I've been talking about him for years as we've been talking about Pivetta and Velasquez along with him for years. I would just like him to do well. And so everyone can stop talking about, will he do well this year?
Mm-hmm.
I think hopefully this year we've reached that point so we could stop it going forward. But even with him, you know, there's a better chance that he's going to have a crappy start that he's going to have a good start. Aaron Nola, there's like a greater chance he's going to have a great start.
Well, I guarantee you we're not going to talk about Zach Eflin. I have no plans to bring him up. So you are in the clear. But I did want to talk about one Phillies player we haven't seen much of. Liz, Nick Williams reappeared yesterday.
Who?
In the Phillies season finale with the Braves. He came in the eighth inning as a pinch runner. And yeah, we hadn't seen him for quite some time. I believe Scott Fransky made a quip about like, oh, I didn't know he still had a uniform. What was it like over 2 weeks since Nick Williams, who has been with the team, has not done anything for the team. What is the point of him being here if his job is to do nothing?
I don't know. I have no idea why he's there. I don't know what he did. Like, did he sleep with Kletak's wife? I'm seriously considered. Like, what could he have done to make? He's a person who plays baseball. Why is he not playing?
Well, and the situation kind of made it even more clear that, to your point, I can't eliminate the possibility of this being a deeply personal, spiteful issue, because this was a situation where at one point in this game they needed a pinch runner for Gene Segura and they went with Michael Franco over Nick Williams, who was available. Nick Williams, probably the fastest person available for them at that point. I'm sure, again, you break that situation down. Bringing in Franco was some sort of genius move that Galaxy Brains came up with that we can't even comprehend. I'm sure that's the case. I'm kind of joking and not joking. Like, there definitely is a reason for it. I'm not sure if I would have agreed with it. Whatever. Point is, that's sort of what stirred the conversation on my end. I sort of brought that up and people were like, well, he's not playing because he's not good. And it's like, yes, well, obviously, I'm not suggesting that he is good. I am suggesting that this is a situation for which he was the best fit. And for a team that plays the matchups so much, it's especially glaring that he was utterly ignored. And instead, Michael Franco, who is a lot of things, is not a skilled runner, is not a fast runner to enter the game as a pinch runner in a close game. A game you assume the Phillies are trying to win just made you think, what's going on here? What is with that situation? And I'm at the point where it must be some sort of personal thing. Or it's like we talked about on Hidden Season. Sometimes if you don't fit the Phillies mold of what they view as a good baseball player, you're not just a baseball player that doesn't add up for them. You don't exist. You are not real. And you can't factor into anything they do.
J.P. Crawford, ladies and gentlemen, like, that proves it. He's a good player. He wasn't the player that they want him to be. He wasn't on board with what they were doing. But mm-hmm. Nick Williams has been here for a while. Why is he not playing? I hopefully, if they're going to release him into the wild this offseason, I don't see why they wouldn't, considering they obviously don't care about playing him. Hopefully he picks up with a good team. Or any team where he can get some playing time, because he deserves it. And I don't know why we feel that way about some of these players that leave the team. Like, we hope they pick up with a team that treats them the way they should be treated, because the Phillies aren't doing that. And that's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Why aren't they doing that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a team that's really defined itself by, like, there's great players on this team, but it's also gone out of its way. And this is the organizational philosophy and how Gabe Kapler seems to run things in game. To just empty that bench when they see fit, to play the matchups, to use the numbers, and to think that with expanded rosters, you bring Nick Williams up and then don't use him. Yeah, he's not very good, and we know who he is at this point. And like you said, I'd love to see him succeed somewhere else. It's not going to be in Philadelphia. But why he gets zero playing time is weird. Like, even I said this yesterday, even Andrew Knapp has gotten a rep or two, despite JT Realmuto having to be dragged off the field by horses. So it's always strange when a player is there but gets zero playing time, like, at all. That the third string catcher the Phillies brought up. I don't know. What is he doing there? Like, is he there to make the start on the last day of the season?
I mean, at the very least, they're all on the major league roster. They're all getting paid. like they're on a major league roster. They're getting paid a portion of whatever the minimum, which is, I think, like $560,000 or something like that. So they're getting paid every day, you know, whatever the daily salary of that would be, which is a good thing.
What is it, like, is it like $850 an hour? Like, what is it?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like bagging groceries at the local store. But, you know, and that's good. You know, Nick Williams has been up and down, you know. Is it Devi Grion? That's him?
Yes. I'm never sure about the pronunciation, so I was going to let you do it. And that plan succeeded.
Sure, why not? I think that's, I mean, I don't know if I've heard his name spoken, but I'm going to, if that's not it, please someone correct me. I'm literally dying to be corrected here. But like, has he gotten into a game? No, I don't think so.
I don't believe so. If he has, it's been, you know, it's been a blip, like Nick Williams coming in as a pinch runner.
Like, I can't imagine he won't get at least an at bat in the next couple. But like, if they're going to sign JP Crawford, Jesus, JT Realmuto long term, like Devi Grion is he's supposed to be like the next catcher that they've been developing, which is tough. Developing catchers is hard. And so unless they want him to be a backup, they're going to have to trade him because there's no room for him. If JT Realmuto, as he has said recently, would be real open to being a Philly for the rest of his life, which made my heart just flutter.
Yes. So I did want to mention that as well. Obviously, it's crucial for the Phillies to lock up JT Realmuto, who cost them their number one prospect via trade earlier this offseason, and has since then become continued to be the best catcher in baseball. Nobody cuts down more base runners. Nobody's more productive at the plate as a catcher. I mean, he's probably going to get MVP votes.
Oh, no
after,
doubt.
After his first season with the Phillies, and knowing he's on the team is one of the reasons it feels so criminal that they underperformed so much.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, guys will often say this about the team they're on. They want to get paid. They want security. It's, you know, understandable. But I'm always just, I don't know. Part of me was like, is he going to want to be here? And honestly, I was excited, you know, to see him say that. What he said was, according to Todd Zielecki, quote, "I wouldn't be opposed at all to staying here for the rest of my career, you know? Right now, I'm going to focus on this playoff push, but once the offseason comes, I look forward to having those discussions." Honestly, it was a relief. It was a relief because
holding all this against us.
This team has not been the most appealing looking from the outside. We don't know exactly what's going on the inside, but we know that there's some philosophical shifting and adherence that might be, to some players, you don't know, problematic. You know, maybe he doesn't necessarily buy into what they're doing, and he's thinking like, look, I'm going to do my 2 years here, and then I'm going to look elsewhere, and I'm going to have my options, assuming I stay healthy. You know, that he's willing to stay here, and all he is willing to stay here. It doesn't mean he's like, I definitely want to be here. This place has really made an impression on me. He was very succinct and polite in his JT Realmuto way. This team has to have him a lot more than he has to have them, I guess, is my point.
Oh, yeah. He knows it.
So for him to say that, it was just like, oh, thank God. At least the possibility exists. Both sides have been publicly like, yes, we want this. So I don't know. I mean, did you feel, was it just like, you know, excitement that like, yay, we're going to lock this guy up? Or was it like relief? Because the next part of this is, are the Phillies going to go about this in a way that ends with him locked up?
I mean, it was both excitement and relief somehow all at once, because, you know, I was worried that he would say something, you know, he was going to be asked about it and he didn't have to be that, you know, he could have been more effusive, but he certainly could have been less, much, much less. He stated a desire to stay here for the rest of his career. You know, it's made enough of an impression on him in the last year. I'm not going to lie. I think some of that is based on the fact that Gabe Kapler will let him play whenever he wants.
Yes, he must love that.
I really think that has so much to do with it. So let's get him locked up before they fire Kapler into the sun, which I'm going to guess will happen sometime next year.
And Realmuto did expand on the Phillies, and he said that it's been a first-class organization all around. The way they treat my family, the fans are tough, but they're here, they're passionate, they care about the game. He likes this group of guys. It's a great clubhouse. The team just gels. It's a place I enjoy. He felt like the core is here. Spoke in a lot of very short, fragmented sentences. But, you know, the point got across. He feels like the Phillies have set themselves up to succeed. And though that success might not be happening now, that in the future, it is a success that he could potentially be a big part of. So It's good to know he looks at it like that. And honestly, we shouldn't be devastated. Like, this team has been disappointing, but I don't think anybody should be devastated. You know what I mean? Like, in the long term, the Phillies are still set up to be a good team moving forward. Yeah, this season sucks. And honestly, I don't necessarily buy the moving of the goalposts from signing Bryce Harper, we're World Series bound, to, okay, you know what, this was a rebuilding year actually, so never mind, and next year is supposed to be the real time that we go for that. I don't really buy that, but we're going to talk about that in a couple minutes here, because Matt Klentak gave some quotes this week that will
emerge from his turtle shell.
We'll talk about, and we'll get to some Matt Klentak discussion right after this break. Well, Liz, Matt Klentak came down to SunTrust Park in Atlanta during this series to have individual meetings with Phillies players alongside Gabe Kapler, get some feedback for how they think things have gone this year.
Why is now the time? Why are they doing their exit interviews now at SunTrust Park?
It is kind of strange. That's according to Matt Gelb of The Athletic. It is sort of entertaining to imagine them being like, all right, season's still over, definitely still in it, we're making a playoff push, but everyone come into this room individually and tell me what you think went wrong this year. There's nothing to do with how we think this season. We totally believe in you guys, 100% behind you, but if you do want to do, like, if you want to start packing up the bags, that would be probably really helpful to the clubhouse staff.
I'm thinking of this as, like, on The Good Fight. Years ago, we used to do, you know, our end of season reviews. We call them exit interviews. And early when we first came up with the concept, we came very, very closer to it being a little bit more surreal, where we would actually pretend that Ruben Amaro was actually doing an exit interview with this player. But this is how it's striking me. Like, it's, they're just sitting in an office, you know, with, you know, Klentak behind an enormous desk where he's just sort of dwarfed by it.
Yeah.
And, like, the players on the other side going, all right, well, I'm here. I could be practicing, so what can I do for you? And Klentak with his tiny turtle voice is like, well, I think, could you tell me what you thought about the year?
Just want to discuss the things you felt went right and the things you felt went wrong. And
it's like Kermit, but worse.
Liz, if you were in one of those meetings, what would you have said? Would you have torn him a new one, or would you have calmly just shuffled through a deck of index cards with your points on them?
That's a really good question. I feel like I could have done both, because I'm a fan of organizing my angry thoughts and angry points into, like, an angry PowerPoint. Sounds like it would be a really fun thing to make. I'm also a dork, but an angry Phillies PowerPoint. I'd be like, sign me up. Can I find, like, I would go through Getty and I'd find all of the images of Phillies, you know, like Bryce Harper trying to catch a ball, making a weird face, like the ball's, you know, the glove is against his face, or, like, you know, other weird Phillies pictures, and use them to illustrate why this year has been a disappointment and why Matt Klentak is also a disappointment.
Whose meeting do you think was the most interesting? If we're imagining a situation where each of the Phillies has cycled through these individual meetings, you know, whose do you think really got the most heated or eye-opening?
I can't. My first thought was imagining a meeting with Nick Williams, where Nick Williams walks in, he's like, hey, guys. And Matt Klentak is just, like, you know, talking to one of his assistants and doesn't say anything. Guys, I'm here. You know, they don't notice, and, you know, they look around like, huh, I guess Nick didn't show up for his meeting. You know, then they just sort of walk out the room and, you know, turn the lights off with him still in there going, guys.
Oh, guys, I have so many thoughts. Hello?
But my real answer, it might be Rhys Hoskins.
Hmm.
Despite what everyone has said, you know, despite... It seems like his great relationship with everybody and what Gabe Kapler said about him growing ostensibly, despite numbers showing us it's been a very frustrating season again. I feel like he has a lot of opinions. I feel like a lot of the time when he's speaking to the media, all of his opinions are just barely simmering under the surface.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's so much more there. I don't know if I would have said that a few years ago, but I really feel like, I mean, watching him and the type of player he is, because he's not, he's, you know, he was our most passionate player before Bryce Harper got here. And then when you see Bryce Harper, it's like there's a gap the size of an ocean between them. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Hoskins is still a very vocal, very passionate player. And I, watching him and knowing that that's how he plays, I have to think he's got a lot of thoughts and opinions about how things are going. Because he, you know, at one point was the, you know, de facto clubhouse leader. He took that mantle on himself because there was no one else to take it.
Yeah.
And
then when Bryce Harper showed up, there was no friction as far as like leadership goes. You know, it's not like Harper stole the mantle away from him, but he definitely became the most the face of that clubhouse, the vocal leader of that clubhouse, the guy anybody's going to go to get a quote
about
the general state of things. Yeah.
As well, I feel like it stopped being just Riz Hoskins and became more people to carry the load, more of a collaborative effort. You know, it's not just Riz Hoskins like beating, you know, Odubel Herrera on the head with just like a newspaper, like, hello, why are you not showing up on time? It's everybody, you know, it's more people there together doing it, which I think has helped him maybe psychologically. I don't know if it's helped on the field. Not that any of that could really contribute, but
I mean, that's the thing. Like, I believe there's a highly productive 1-2 punch to take advantage of in Harper and Hoskins in the lineup, but it's tough to take advantage of that when Hoskins will disappear for months at a time and not be an effective hitter at the plate. Certainly not so in the way we've seen. And I feel like in a meeting, a one-on-one meeting, yeah, he might have a lot of thoughts, but a lot of their responses are going to come down to the fact that, like, hey, you know, you got to come through here too. I really like Riz Hoskins. I just wonder at the end of this season, we know a little bit more about what kind of player he is. And John Stolness has been asking for years, is his ceiling Pat Burrell or is there somebody else in there? And now we have another season under our belts where he didn't really show much more than that. And if that's the kind of player he is, then fine. But that's not necessarily a player who's a cornerstone for a franchise, I think it's fair to say. And there's been, you know, most of it generated by frustration and grumbling, but not actual happenings. But talk of potentially trading Riz Hoskins, not from the team or anybody, just sort of the idea came up. Whereas like a year ago, that wouldn't have even been discussed among fans. Like, oh, we should get, but you know, this is a fan base where a lot of the time when a player is struggling, it's like, well, why don't we just trade him and replace him with a good player? And
literally every time.
Not how that works. But, you know, the general idea, Liz, are you open to the idea of potentially Riz Hoskins getting moved to help one of this team's problem areas? Because I'm not really. This season, you know, was frustrating. I don't think it was enough to move on from him. And also, you know, moving Carlos Santana out so Riz Hoskins could play first base was one of the better things this team did in the offseason. Of course, you know, they were also the ones who acquired Carlos Santana in the first place.
And once they got rid of him, he had an all-star season.
Terrific year. Terrific year in Cleveland.
Everyone everyone who came to the Phillies and then left, pretty much all of them have had a great season.
Mm-hmm. They had.
It's fascinating.
Yes.
Really, really makes you think.
Is Riz Hoskins a big factor in this team's future?
I think he is. I think the front office loves him. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I don't want to see him go. But if trading him for a better play, you know, if trading him for a really great player, like I didn't want to trade Sixto Sanchez, but we got JT Realmuto for him. If trading him would get an immediate impact player with some control, I'd be down. I mean, I'm not saying I want it to happen. I'm not saying I would be happy for it to happen. But I would be able to understand it. I would understand it. I would probably feel the same way I did about the Crawford trade with that got us Segura. Because I loved J.P. Crawford. But I understood that, you know, we needed the Phillies needed an infielder very badly. And yeah. Segura is very strong and he was further developed than Crawford. And the Phillies, for what they told us they were doing at the time, they didn't really have the time or patience to nurture him in the way that he needed to be. They needed a team like the Mariners who, despite how they looked at the beginning of the season, were most likely not going anywhere and could give him a lot of playing time without feeling like it's actively hurting the team. So I don't know if I'd feel exactly the same way, but I'd feel similar. I don't want him to go. I feel like someone is going to bring this up and be like, you obviously hate him and want him to leave. No, I love him dearly and I want him to stay, but I also want him to do well. I want him to improve. And so I think his meeting with Klentak would be interesting because you can't really ignore what the numbers are telling you. And as we've said, they have more numbers that we don't even know about. And so I wonder what those numbers say. Yeah. And I mean,
they know when he's going to die.
Yeah, at this point.
Analytics is really intense. Yeah,
exactly. So I think that's going to be an interesting meeting. I would love to know what they plan to have him do over the offseason. I'd like to know if they plan to have him work with anybody, if he plans to hire a personal hitting coach, as people have done. I don't think that would be a bad thing. I think it's worth a try. Why not go live with Charlie Manuel? Him and his wife, just pack up and go live in Charlie Manuel's basement for a while.
Yeah.
I feel like the two of them could be the best of friends, don't you?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Reese can get along with anybody. So can Charlie. And the information that could be passed between the two of them would be of the most value to the Phillies. So, yeah, I think that's a relationship to cultivate. Absolutely.
Just stick Mikel Franco in there, too. And it can just be like this great buddy comedy. Put him in a car, have him drive across the country. I'm down.
I think Scott Kingery's meeting probably was a little interesting. Mm-hmm. I at least would have been curious just because his role, it remains gelatinous. I feel like,
that's a great way to put it.
He certainly had a better season this year, and I'm excited to see where he goes. I want him to be as productive a player as the Phillies have always imagined him to be. Obviously, last year, that didn't super happen. This year, he took a lot of steps forward. It's been really exciting. And I'm always curious about the conversations the Phillies have with Kingery, because I don't know if they'll ever find a position that they stick him in as his position until, assuming he's here much later in his career, where they want him to stop moving around, or he's not moving around as much. I'm very curious about his future, because his position is going to fit into their future plans kind of regardless, whether that's in center field, at third base, at second base. I mean, when you play so many positions and the intent is for you to be a utility player, but good, you're going to fit into the team's plans in a lot of ways moving forward. So there's no way his name doesn't come up in pretty much every conversation. And I'd be curious to see what his general thoughts are about being in that situation. So, yeah, a lot of stuff to think about moving forward, but a lot of them from the mouth of Matt Klentak this week, as Matt Gelbup from The Athletic and Jim Salisbury from NBC Sports Philly both put up pieces featuring words from the mouth of Klentak himself. From Gelb's piece, Klentak said that he wanted to, quote, change the narrative about the deadline, the trade deadline, and wanted people to focus on the success the team had found in the deals that they had made, not who they didn't acquire. What Klentak said was, quote, I understand that sometimes what you give up can serve as a proxy for aggressiveness or intent, but I think there's also a value in reading a market and trying to make the best deals that you can. I know that some of the players that we brought in may not have been household names, but I think most of them have performed in such a way that they've delivered what we hope they'd deliver, which is adding depth to our bullpen and keeping us in games in our rotation. So I would say in response to that, and a lot of times, no, they haven't actually done that.
It's really that's so disingenuous for him to take a very minor, not even complaint, just a recognition that fans, like, we don't know who these guys are, who are they, and taking that and using it as the, you know, fans are angry that, you know, these aren't household names, they think they're not worth it. And like, no, fans are angry because you made no moves for players that are established and good. Like, that's so disingenuous for him to say. It's just mischaracterizing the argument that not just fans, but many incredibly engaged fans, like people at The Good Fight and us on this podcast, have made. Like, it's so frustrating to hear him say that, because shut up.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, was Cliff Lee a household name when the Phillies acquired him in 2009? Joe Blanton was not a household name when the Phillies acquired him in 2008. And people rallied behind, you know, him when
they
was effective.
Yeah, they rally behind players who are good, which Corey Dickerson was great. And the Pirates, who are an underrated, huge trash organization. Like, at this point, almost irredeemable when you look at all of their moves. And that, not just that, the players that they have brought into their, we're just going to take a second for me to complain about the Pirates. The players that they brought into their clubhouse a number of them have reputations as being troublemakers with short tempers. One of them tried to sleep with a 13-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
The Pirates are a garbage organization, and they literally, they gave Corey Dickerson away for nothing. I think it was international money that the Phillies had to give, which they have an abundance of. And yeah. Corey Dickerson was by far, I think he has been the most productive player on the Phillies since he was acquired, and then he broke his foot.
What a compelling cameo appearance Corey Dickerson made on the 2019.
Yes, in the movie of the Phillies, in the movie of the Phillies season, it's really just a little peekaboo.
He showed up, he hit 293, and then disappeared after about 6 weeks with a broken foot. I mean, damn. Yeah, I mean, and we've given Glenn Tack credit for that. We've given him credit for picking up, all the position players he's picked up for the most part. You know, they haven't all been hits, but at the time of their acquisition, were all viewed as pretty solid moves, if a little desperate at times. But the Dickerson move this year, Jay Bruce signing, paid pretty immediate dividends if he has faded away, which he has significantly. But Dickerson has been a strong hitter since the Phillies acquired him. And it's a shame that they lost him because he became one of their best offensive threats. But, you know, Matt Glenn, he wants credit. He wants credit for acquiring Jason Vargas. He wants credit for acquiring Drew Smyly, Mike Morin, Blake Parker. And I'm sorry, I just can't give it to you. And I'm not fully blaming you for the situation. If you go back and listen to those podcasts, we talked about how this team was not worth giving up top prospects to acquire Madison Bumgarner, to acquire Mike Minor. This team was not worth maybe going all in because they hadn't proven that they were capable of it, even with a few adjustments. So I understand that that context is important. It is. But also, we can see the same results that he can. So blaming fans just for not for the name recognition of Jason Vargas and Drew Smyly for not being that high.
Blaming fans for not understanding.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the reputation that this front office is sadly building, that they have this weird contempt for the fans, which, hey, look, fans, if your job is to keep a giant billion-dollar franchise operating at its most efficient and talented level, having a audience of tens of thousands of people clamoring about how shitty you are at your job, that would drive me crazy too. But at the same time, you know, as a member of that crowd of 10,000, you also gotta assume we're not as dumb as we think you are. And I think that you're starting to get the impression Matt Glentak, based on his limited number of public appearances and public addresses and the things he says on occasion, he really doesn't seem to treasure the fans' take on things very much. Which, you know, again, you sort of don't blame him for, but at the same time, come on, man, give us a little credit here. What? Because it's hard to give him credit, given the success that we've also seen guys like Wade Miley, Charlie Morton, Patrick Corbin, Dallas Keuchel, you know, and these situations all differed. But in the cases of Corbin and Keuchel, who have both been phenomenal for the teams they signed with, who both also happen to be NL East rivals of the Phillies, by the way, all the Phillies would have had to have given up was money. And the Phillies decided, in Corbin's case, they couldn't play ball as high as he wanted to go. And in the years, presumably, the 6-year deal, Dallas Keuchel, they didn't apparently talk to at all. So then you look over at the Phillies, and what did they get? Well, there's a gaping hole where this team's starting pitching has been. So it's tough not to make that connection. And throwing Jason Vargas and Drew Smyly out there, we did something. I mean, that's why they made those moves, to look like they had done something, to be able to say that they did something and that they didn't do nothing. And that is frustrating, because those names may not be as recognizable, but there's a reason they're not as recognizable. So I don't know. But like I said, the Phillies kept their top prospects and did not give up much for a season that we on this podcast said was not worth giving up good young players. So
exactly. It's the honesty that I'm looking for, because he's mischaracterizing.
Mm-hmm.
He's mischaracterizing the argument. And of course, he's not going to say, well, you know, the team wasn't doing that well, we didn't have any faith in them, which is obviously what it was. It's obviously what it was.
Yes.
But Matt Gelb wrote in a piece yesterday on The Athletic that the Phillies are this. It struck me when he wrote it. The Phillies are very sensitive to criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, they care deeply about their team. But what criticism are they sensitive to?
Right.
Is it ours? Because we're just two idiots for the podcast. Yes, we've watched the team for years. But the I like the idea that we can influence them, but this doesn't seem to be influence. It seems to be they look at people not agreeing with them on the internet and get angry about it.
It's so strange. And this started last year when word came out that, I believe it was Ken Rosenthal wrote that the team was too embarrassed at Carlos Santana to move him after acquiring him for a year. Strange, bizarre. You're a baseball team. Make the moves you're going to make. I mean, we'll either agree or disagree with them, but what? You're too embarrassed to move a player? What's wrong with you? Get a spine.
Exactly. It's not that bothered me so much. Because the point of a baseball team is to win, not to look good while you're doing it. It's to just win. And if he's not helping you win, you get rid of him. If you have a player you want to take his place, then do it. Carlos Santana destroyed a television in the clubhouse last year that we didn't find out until way afterwards. That alone is enough reason to trade him.
There is a comic book series of events that I have a feeling we're going to hear about at the end of this season as well. I feel like this is going to be the pattern. The Phillies clubhouse locked up tight throughout the regular season during this regime, and then we're going to find out some comically bizarre stories about what impacted the moments of this season we remember.
It's only when they let players go.
Yeah.
I mean, I think Carlos Santana hadn't been traded, but I would be curious to find out what Sean Rodriguez has to say after he's no longer a Philly.
Yeah, I mean, think about what he had to say while he still was a Philly, and yeah, boy, if there's even more going on, be very curious about that. Well, we're gonna take a quick break here, and we'll be right back. We got some more Matt Klentak talk to go over, and then we'll jump back to 2009 as we sometimes do on this podcast, and remember where the Phillies were at this point in their 2009 season. So we'll be right back after this break. Well, beyond Matt Gelb's piece in The Athletic, which was pretty good, it had a money paragraph that I think pleased a lot of people just with Gelb's own conjecture on the Phillies right now. That's definitely worth a read. But Jim Salisbury at NBC Sports also wrote a piece with a bunch of Matt Klentak quotes in it, getting his thoughts on a variety of topics, the kind of topics we talk about a lot on the internet. And from Jim Salisbury, Klentak was asked about Gabe Kapler's future with the team. And, you know, he naturally backed his manager, saying that Kapler has done a, quote, remarkable job managing the bullpen in the wake of injuries to seven different key relievers, as well as the rest of the roster. And, you know, Liz, to that point, it can't be forgotten that this team was utterly ravaged by injuries.
True.
That is true. I just remain of the mind that with a healthy team, I have not seen anything from Gabe Kapler as a manager that makes me think he has this high level of skill that with a completely healthy team, he is able to manage them in this brilliant way. I don't know. I feel like he could be swapped out and you wouldn't see too much of an impact, I guess, is my point.
I think that's true of most modern managers.
I agree.
A handful. That's not true. Maybe and when I say handful, I mean one or two. But the modern manager, they want a guy who's going to execute the plan that they set out. They don't want a guy with independent thought. Like Charlie Manuel could never be a manager again. There's a reason why Dusty Baker isn't managing. Because they're old school baseball guys who set their lineups and then they let the players play. Like Dusty Baker and Charlie Manuel, to an extent, neither of them were very good at bullpen management. That's true. That's an aspect of the game that I think managers have gotten much better at because front offices have gotten better. But when it comes to everything else, Charlie would put his guys in and let them play because you trust them to play well. You know, that's what you do. You trust your players to do what they're supposed to do, even if they have, you know, platoon splits or whatever, even if they hit, you know, lefties better than righties. I mean, I have no doubt that, I mean, God, Ryan Howard's splits were ridiculous for years. Yeah. And he played against both-handed players because that's what you do. I mean, granted, people could say, you know, like now we know much better and you have the Mike Petriello's of the world, the Tom Tangos of the world screaming, but this is how baseball evolves. Make it less fun. Trust players less. No one is as good as you think they are. But that's what managers used to do, and it used to work just fine. I don't think anything is working better with the overmanaging that we're seeing now. But because that's what front offices want, you can stick anybody in there. They just need to be a guy that the players like and trust and who is a good communicator, which Gabe Kapler tells us all the time that he is. Just ask him.
Well, Klentak also talked about the coaching staff as a whole, saying, quote, the players are the ones who do those things. They're the ones who deserve the credit. But I think a lot of that credit can be shared with a really impactful coaching staff that has spent a lot of time working on things that over the course of a season turn into much bigger things. Now, this is a coaching staff that is no longer contains John Malley, the hitting coach, who was fired and replaced with Charlie Manuel. It is a coaching staff that Chris Young, the pitching coach, has been under scrutiny for much of this, I would say probably the entirety of the second half, if not the majority of the season, based on what we've seen from the Phillies pitching staff. Now, again, you bring up the health because it is an unarguable factor. And Matt Klentak's going to hit you with that as often as he can when you ask him about this team's success from a leadership and coaching standpoint. But I don't know if it's it might be a little bit of Klentak speak to say this is a team that you got to give credit to the coaching staff. And it makes you wonder, credit for what? This is a team that's been clinging to a 5 games over .500 record, but played largely like a .500 team. If you look at where they rank as a team in a lot of offensive categories, they are just a hair under mediocre, just a hair under league average. 17th ranked among all major league teams. You know, right around the middle, but lower than the top half. They obviously, like I said, fired their hitting coach. Chris Young is, you know, his tenure here has been debated for some time, given how he came to the position, which was that the Braves showed interest in him. The Phillies said no. The Braves instead went with Rick Kranitz, the Phillies' actual pitching coach at the time. Chris Young was promoted to that position. And we've seen the same pitchers who have struggled to break through and achieve consistent success struggle to break through and achieve consistent success. We've seen Aaron Nola look not as dominant for long stretches, as he did in 2018. We've seen Jake Arrieta announce that he has bone spurs and then continue to pitch with bone spurs. We've seen the front office acquire garbage heap guys like Drew Smyly or bottom of the rotation guys like Jason Vargas and tout them as effective new pitchers to help this team. So what does the coaching staff want credit for, I guess, is my question, Liz.
Being there, not getting anybody killed. breathing air. I don't know. I mean, I guess there are things that we don't see, but what we do see is that pretty much every pitcher has taken a step back or is not improved. And the one thing that I hear when we talk about how the Rick Kranitz, Chris Young kerfuffle, you know, that the Braves pretty much almost trolled the Phillies into letting them have the pitching coach they wanted. They say, you know, the Braves pitching staff hasn't been great either. You could say that's true. But they also, it's not a pitching staff that has taken steps backwards. They haven't taken any major steps backwards. They've been able to manage things throughout the year. They've been at least competent. They haven't been hit, I think, with as many injuries. But whenever anyone says, you know, well, the Braves pitchers haven't been doing that well, I'm just like, but the Phillies pitchers are doing worse.
Yeah, like unarguably.
It's worse. Anybody who is just like taking pride in the fact that the Braves are going out there and throwing a complete game every time, I'm like, there's nothing to say that if they had not left Rick Kranitz in place, they would not have been the same as last year. And if Aaron Nola had been the same as last year, even if Jake Arrieta had been the same as last year, because at least I think he pitched most of the season, if not all of it.
Yeah,
maybe I'm misremembering, but that would have been fine. The point is to move forward or to not get worse. And what happened is everyone got worse. Well, the Braves pitchers, at the very least, stayed the way they were.
I'm going to give a coaching staff credit if the team goes, like the bullpen gets destroyed by injuries. You lose your leadoff hitter. You lose Scott Kingery for a stretch. You lose Bryce Harper for a couple of days. I mean, you know. If you go through all these things that the Phillies couldn't control and you're a coaching staff that still has this team in first place in a playoff spot, absolutely. Credit? Yes. This is a team that wants, I guess, credit for still having a winning record despite all that, but has not looked good or dominant, has still only gotten as hot as to win four games in a row and no more, but was capable of losing seven games in a row, their losing streaks being, you know, more prominent than their winning streaks. I don't know what is it this team has achieved that you want credit for, and that's kind of the long and short of it here. Like, I'd love to give you some credit. I would love for this narrative to be true. I just don't know what it is you're pointing to when you say, yeah, but look at what we've accomplished. You know, yeah, we're not in last place is what I'm hearing, you know, and in a division where you're playing with the Marlins, you probably weren't going to finish in last place without really trying to anyway.
Yeah. It's a coaching staff, and no one really knows how much they do or what they deserve credit for, you know. And Kletak's right; like the players are the ones that actually do it or don't do it. They're the ones that pitch well or don't pitch well, you know. And the coaches are there to help and support and point things out, but they are important. And that there has not been any market improvement in anyone is really frustrating. You know, the bullpen, you know, it's like a weed whacker went through there. And it's really tough to blame them for that. So I won't blame the coaches for the bullpen. Who you blame for the bullpen is the GM for not getting more guys in immediately. Like, when it was obvious that some of these guys were going to be out for more than a month, you're like, all right, well, we could figure out what to do with some of these guys when we finally are back to full strength. Let's bring in at the beginning of the season, there are tons of dudes still unsigned everywhere. They were everywhere. And a bunch of guys went down early, and I don't think there was anything really done. Craig Kimbrell was out there.
Yeah.
And they're still saying, no, David Robertson was never going to be our closer. He was going to be our setup guy. We don't need to bring in anybody big name to replace him. We still have Hector Neris, who cannot throw a pitch without allowing a base runner. The dude allows base runners when he's sleeping.
Yeah.
He cannot be a closer. And granted, the Phillies don't like to use that word, I think. I don't really know what their attitude is on that today. But it's obvious that Neris has been the closer, whether they call him that or not. And he shouldn't be, because he walks guys constantly. And that's not a closer. Brad Lidge didn't walk, dudes.
Ugh. Well, in Salisbury's piece, Klentak also talked about how each season must be looked at individually. He said that, yes, wins and losses determine whether or not it is a success, but each one has its own context. He said, quote, the circumstances change, the player personnel can change, expectations can change. There are a lot of things that are different year in and year out. So that being said, we're going to try to link this to our 2009 talk. You know, around this time in 2009, Shane Victorino was recovering from a stomach bug, and Brett Myers had a sore shoulder, and JC Romero and Scott Ayer were on the DL, and Brad Lidge was still trying to prove he could close games, and Charlie Manuel's kind of sad. Andy Martino had a column in the Philadelphia Inquirer about Manuel, and saying, you know, this team has struggled at times. Charlie Manuel was on them like earlier in September about looking complacent at the plate, looking lost. And to Charlie Manuel, a former hitting coach, looking clueless during an at-bat is probably the worst sin you can commit. You know, we've said about the 2019 Phillies pretty late in the season, we didn't know who they were. We were worried about, like, oh, they don't have really an identity. And it sounds kind of silly now, given that, like, the statistics are still pretty bad. And that's kind of what determines whether the team wins or loses. But we were saying, you know, we don't know who this team is. This team in 2009 was apparently battling that same dual identity problem. I don't remember that as well. But they had, you know, coming off a World Series victory, you feel like you know a team pretty well regardless. But Martino was trying to paint it that, like, this team is, which team is it? Is this team the underperforming team we saw at the beginning of September, or is this team the World Series champions who are going to go all the way again? So, I mean, first of all, how do you remember this 2009 team when we talk about them? Like, I don't think they were dominant, and they certainly weren't the best team from this stretch of division winners, but I feel like they were definitely better than the 2008 team, and I don't think that's up for debate.
No, and I mean, I don't remember them searching for an identity, because they were almost the exact same team they were the year before.
It seemed like a stretch. He had an idea for a column, and he just kind of wrote it based on some down ticks in the stats that happened at the beginning of the month. Now, that being said, Matt Klentak talked about this year, you know, like I just said, expectations change during a season. When do you think the Phillies' expectations changed? And do you think that maybe they should have let us know when they did so that we could change ours too? Because, yeah, here he is talking about how, you know, hey, we acquired these names. They're not household names. You may not have known the value in them. Don't worry. We knew the value in these guys when we acquired them, and they've done an okay job. But at the same time, he says expectations can change. Those two things are connected, you know, like this team went and got guys who were not the best pitchers, but were new pitchers for the Phillies because they didn't think, and you know, this is conjecture, but it's conjecture based on evidence. They didn't think this team was worth giving up what they'd have to give up to get real talent and letting this team make a genuine playoff push. So, you know, clearly the Phillies' expectations changed from when they signed Bryce Harper and wanted you to, like, buy tickets and you know, sign up for this because the Phillies are back. And the trade deadline, when they were like, well, we're going to hold back here a little bit. So I don't know. I mean, what is your take on that?
There are two dueling narratives about, I mean, and Klentak has recognized neither, but there's the Phillies weren't good enough to warrant giving up a top prospect, which is one of the trade deadline things. The other one is that they were potentially scared of the Dodgers. One of those is okay, and one of them is not. And I'm curious as to which one it actually was. And it could have been both, and Klentak will never let us know either. But I want to know, like, if expectations really did truly change, then that's fine. And they're never going to let us know. But I'm not convinced that it was that. I'm not necessarily convinced that that's how they felt, because the fact that the Dodgers are such a behemoth feels real. It feels like a real thing that teams, you know, that teams take into account. Like, I don't think this team is good enough to beat the, not just good enough to compete, but I don't think they're good enough to beat the Dodgers. And so I'm not going to go out and get anybody better.
Yeah. I mean, that was a straw man argument presented by Ken Rosenthal, but at the same time, he mentioned it as part of that column we talked about, I guess it was last week, for a reason. You know, that it's kind of believable to think that the sentiment behind that argument is true to an extent. I mean, Jason Stark had brought that up as well earlier in the season. So that's frustrating to consider that is a driving force behind it. But at the same time, it's also, you know, it's got to be true behind closed doors. You know, like, if you're like, look, this is the team we have. It's halfway through the season. This offense is not as powerful as we thought for whatever reason. At this point, it doesn't matter why. It's not bailing out the starting pitching, and our bullpen has been destroyed. We thought that was going to help prop up the starting pitching woes as well. They're not. Now the weakness is still a weakness, and what we thought were going to be strengths are also weaknesses. Meanwhile, the Dodgers are winning 120 games with the kind of bench depth we dream about. So at this point, it's not worth it. That being one of the reasons it's not worth it. But like to list that as like the main reason, like, well, we're not good enough to beat the Dodgers, screw it, pull the plug. It's like insulting, you know, it's insulting to anybody who watches and follows and spends money on this team.
Exactly.
But, you know,
the insulting aspect, like, it's hard not to listen to GMs and, you know, whatever Andy McPhail is. It's hard not to listen to them speak to the media about the team, about fans, and not feel like they're always insulting our intelligence a little bit just because of the way PR speak has to be, because we're not blind. We see everything. And, you know, my wish always is for more upfront honesty, which is never going to happen. There aren't really any teams that do that. Like, maybe one or two will have like a moment of accidental honesty in front of a microphone. But most of the time, this is how it is. But when it's in this context, it just feels a lot more frustrating because they're saying different things than they did at the beginning of the season and not really recognizing that it's different. And they say expectations change, but they won't tell us how they've changed. Like, we know. We are also here. You know?
Yeah.
I always long for more. I always long for more honesty. And I feel like that's just something that's never going to happen. We're never going to get it.
No, we're not. And I mean, that's...
It's dumb of me to even ask or want it.
Yeah, I mean, what do we expect? That they're going to come out and be like, all right, look, things aren't working the way they want. We're kicking the can and we'll see you guys next year. Like, that'll never happen. Like, the team would, they've got to make money. Like, that's at the end of this, the driving force behind keeping a lot of that behind closed doors, obviously. So, you know, we're never going to have that level of honesty. But at this point, we don't really need that level of honesty to kind of understand what's going on and what's happened. You know, yeah, there's a lot of stuff behind closed doors and we're going to find out some more, I'm sure, in the days ahead. But like, you know, you look at this season and you look at the things that have happened for the Phillies, what has worked, what hasn't worked, and the statements that have been released, and you just kind of, you can put two and two together. The narrative seems pretty clear here. That being said, Phillies have a couple more games to play, so we'll be back on continued success next week. We'll, one of these weeks we are going to jump back into the 2009 stuff that we...
The 2019 Phillies are just... They have too much happening.
Dominating the conversation, yeah. But this team that will not make the playoffs versus a team that went to the World Series. But yes, we will be back next week on continued success. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and download all your favorite podcasts that are part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hitting Season with John Stolness, a new episode of The Dirty Inning we snuck in there this week with me and Dr. Trevor Strunk, and of course, continued success. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week on continued success.